Hello, everyone. I'm Viviana Young, the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for Umpqua Watersheds through United Communities AmeriCorps, and the host of Living Downstream.
Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Molalla, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment, which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement.
So with us for today's episode, we have Matthew Hunter and Abraham Finley. Hello, you two. Would you like to introduce your topic of expertise?
Well, I think we're going to talk about birds and stuff like that today.
Birds and photography, both.
All right. How did you two get interested in birds? Matt, you want to start?
Sure. Well, for me, that was a long time ago. That would have been like late 70s. I had a biology teacher, Larry Lee, that took our class out to Cooper Creek Reservoir. I was a junior or senior in high school. We were just in a big yellow school bus. He gave everybody a bird book. It was some rainy winter day, whatever it was. And he said, let's see who can identify some ducks out there. We were at the far end at Cooper Creek Reservoir, the upper end. And I remember thinking, ducks? Ducks are ducks. What do you mean identify ducks? I thought, you know, there's ducks, there's hawks and chickens. And anyway, my friend and I identified an American widgeon.
That's cool.
And it just blew my mind. I thought, oh my gosh, there are different kinds of ducks. And then sort of a similar thing happened a few months later. I thought, well, what about all these little brown things flying around? Maybe there's different kinds of those too. And so it was kind of an eye-opening thing, and it was a lot of fun and went on from there.
Did you end up going to college for ornithology or anything similar to that?
I did end up going to OSU and getting couple different degrees, one in wildlife science and one in forest science.
Interesting. And Abraham, how did you get interested in birds?
I've always been interested in wildlife and fishing and stuff. So like, I think it was my 9th or 10th birthday, my mom got me a hummingbird feeder and a suet feeder. And I put those up and just got really interested in birds and just watching them in the tree in the front yard and backyard.
So do you only photograph birds, or do you just photograph wildlife in general?
Birds and wildlife, yeah, basically anything, any animals.
I happen to know that Abraham's pretty good at spotting a lot of different things. When we were on a field trip a few years ago, there was a mink running along the bank on the other side, and
yeah, I remember that.
He saw that. And most people got to see it. And I actually went back a couple of days later to that side of the river to photograph the tracks. That was fun.
You found the tracks from it?
Yeah.
That's cool.
It was spending quite a lot of time in there. And I put up a couple trail cams too.
Did you get any footage of it on the trail cam?
Yep.
Cool.
And how did you two get connected with each other in the first place?
I think mainly that one field trip. And then we kind of just connected online a bit since then.
Yeah.
Would you say that there's a larger birding community out there, especially locally, that people could get in touch with?
There definitely is. I would say they're not as cohesive around here as in maybe some other areas, but there are quite a few people with a whole range of interests, you know, and there are a couple main ways people connect in relation to birds locally. One is there's a email list called Umpqua Birds. So that's an email list you can sign up for. And there's a Facebook group called Umpqua Basin Naturalists that was sort of an offshoot of that. And people, including Abraham, share pictures and stories, observations, questions.
So it's mostly an online community?
Yeah, there used to be more field trips. Field trips would kind of come and go depending on who has the energy to do that, you know.
So one way that I got connected with birds, I'm an amateur, I'm not as good as you two, but one way that I got connected with birds is that I would go out and feed them with friends and meet up and feed the birds, especially by Fred Meyers. However, a few years ago, I learned that bread is actually really bad for birds. I'm not really sure about the details of that, so I switched to bird seed. What is it about bread that's ill-advised to feed to birds?
So for like the younger goslings, when they eat bread, I'm not totally sure what happens exactly, but I know it can cause something developed called angel wing, which can deform their wings when they eat bread when they're really young. So they can't fly when they get older, which we've seen a few cases of that there from bread.
That's interesting. Is it a deformity? Like, does their wing get bent or something as they develop?
Kind of, yeah. Because it sticks out at a weird angle and they can't really fly.
So I know that I typically don't go birding or feeding birds or doing anything with birds in the colder months, but I don't know if that's a universal thing. Do you two go birding throughout the year or mostly just in the warmer months?
All the time.
Anytime.
And how do you handle birding in the colder months? Is it harder to find them?
Well, in the winter, I mean, there's no leaves on the trees, so it's a lot easier to see birds on the bare trees and the branches.
That's an interesting perspective I hadn't considered. Do most of the birds here migrate or stow themselves away in holes or anything during the winter, or are most of our type of birds more active year-round?
There's a lot of both. Back to your winter birding question. In some ways, it's easier in the winter. I mean, it may be colder on average, but with a lot of the leaves off the trees, like Abraham said. And then another thing that happens in winter is that even the emergent vegetation in a lot of the water bodies dies down, and a lot of ducks show up. And ducks and other waterfowl are probably one of the easier types of birds for people to get used to looking at and identifying, you know, because they're big and they're sitting on the water and they're not hiding in the trees as much. So in some ways, winter can be an easier time. There's also more birds in flocks that time of year. So sometimes you can find whole groups of things. So there's definitely something to see all year round. And then you're asking about migration, and there are some birds that we have here only in the winter. There's some birds we have here only in the summer. There's a few birds that we only have in migration, but a lot of them show up either fall for the whole winter and then leave in the spring, or some of them show up in the spring and stay the summer and then leave in late summer or fall.
Yeah, a lot of waterfowl come for the winter, stay till springtime, and then leave before summer.
Do you have any exciting or interesting stories from birding?
Well, Matt, you remember when we went out to Cooper Creek, the bald eagles?
That was amazing.
That was pretty cool. We went out to Cooper Creek Reservoir, and there's this pair of bald eagles that we saw flying towards us. I'm not sure totally what it's called, but it's some mating ritual. They lock their talons together and kind of spiral through the air towards the ground a little bit and then break apart and then fly off. That was pretty cool.
We both got some pretty amazing pictures of that whole thing. And it's just mind-boggling to see these two huge eagles just talons locked and spiraling down towards the ground.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Then they let go and fly off.
Are there any casualties with that process? It sounds like if they get too close to the ground or if they get too close to the canopy, there might be some complications.
I think they have. There have been reports of them hitting the ground sometimes.
Yeah, it's pretty rare, but I have heard a couple reports of that. And the one that sticks in my mind is I think they actually hit like a power line or something.
Oh, wow.
So what's your favorite bird and why? Let's start with Abraham this time.
There's so many. I have to think about that for a little bit. You want to go while I think about that?
Yeah, I don't really have a favorite particular bird, but among the sparrows, I do have a favorite sparrow. It's called a Lincoln sparrow. And so, you know, for a lot of people, sparrows are just little brown jobbers that they don't pay much attention to because they're all just little and brown. But the reason I really like the Lincoln sparrow, it's kind of petite. All the markings are, some of the streaks are pretty sharp, like they're put on with a pen and ink. And they're also pretty cool, I think, because in Oregon in the winter, we have some down here in the valleys and during migration. But in the summer, they breed up in high elevation meadows, mostly above 4,000 feet. So they're high elevation, beautiful green meadows that need to have some flowing water and some kind of wetland area, and usually at least some patches of shrubs, if not a lot of shrubs. And their singing, it's funny, their singing reminds me kind of a, if you were going to take sort of a babbling brook and turn it into a bird song, that would be the Lincoln sparrow. So it's really kind of appropriate for the habitat they breed in. So I think they're a pretty cool sparrow.
And have you thought of any, Abraham?
I think of one. It's in the falcon family. It's an American kestrel. They're pretty cool. I really like how if you go out to like a big field in the summer, or late spring, you'll see them start to fly out. They'll fly up above the field and they'll hover looking for mice and voles of the field. And then you'll see them dive sometimes and then fly off to a tree or a power pole. They're pretty cool.
And we've talked a bit about Douglas County and Oregon and Oregonian birds. Have either of you been birding somewhere far from Douglas County? And were there any major differences between there and here?
Not really. I've gone up to Washington a little bit.
I've been a few different places, you know, around the country or different countries. But even within Oregon, Oregon is a pretty amazing state because we have so many different habitats. And anybody that's interested in experiencing more and different species, one of the things you want to look for is just visiting different habitats. You know, there's different kinds of water. There's rivers, ocean, lakes, ponds. There's different kinds of forests. There's conifer, you know, fir forests, pine forests, cottonwood, riparian areas. There's shrubs, there's grassland, there's desert, there's alpine, you know, above timberline. All these places have different species. So the more of those different habitats you visit, the more different kinds of birds you'll find. And you can overlay that with season, because different seasons, different birds will show up in those habitats as well. I just looked it up recently to check, and Oregon is still ranked about fifth of all the 50 states in terms of number of species recorded for the state, which is pretty impressive. You know, that's a lot of states. Yeah. The only ones that have recorded more species are, was it California, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico.
So within the same sort of strip of the United States.
Yeah, west and southwest.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that, like, lots of different birds and all these different habitats. I went to a friend's property. They live on like 40 acres and they have like a big field. And then there's like a small forest of like pine and oak, and they have a little pond, all sorts of stuff. And just noticing all the different species that live in what part, what different habitats, like out in the field and the trees. Definitely really cool.
Does Oregon have any unique endemic species?
I don't think it has any endemic species. Oregon is kind of interesting in that it does kind of define the limits of some species ranges. So, for example, California towhee reaches its northernmost distribution, actually here in Douglas County. And there's a few other species like that that as far north as they go is somewhere in Oregon. And there's a few where Oregon represents as far south as they go. But as far as unique species, I don't think Oregon has any endemic bird species.
All right. Well, shifting gears a little to Abraham, what kind of photography equipment do you use?
I use a Sony a6500 with a telephoto lens on it, 70 to 300 millimeters.
Do you often have to do a significant amount of hiking to get to good birding locations?
Not really. I mean, depends on where you're going. But I mean, yeah, it depends on what you're looking for. Like up at Diamond Lake, there's different species up there. And there's certain species you'd have to go hike somewhere to find them. But I don't know, not really.
Abraham's gotten some pretty great photos of birds just flying over his neighborhood. Tell us some cool birds that have just flown over your, you know, your house or where you walk down the road nearby. You've had like golden eagle, common nighthawk, purple martin.
Yeah, I saw about a couple days or a week ago, peregrine falcon flew over my house. I got a photo of that. And then a week or two ago, there's a common nighthawk that flew over, which you don't typically see in this area. Where'd you say that you normally see them? Like Eastern Oregon?
Well, the nighthawks they're just pretty unusual in the valley bottom, but they get more common once you get up into the foothills and the mountains, especially where there's some big open areas.
I've also seen like, I think two golden eagles fly over. Those are really cool. I think the first or second one, I was sitting in my living room, I looked out the window, and I thought it was a juvenile bald eagle at first because, you know, there's no white head. The colors under the wings, the white, kind of looks similar to it. So I thought it was. So I got some pictures, and then afterwards I zoomed in, and I could see that it had a golden head and golden tail feathers. So, yeah, it was pretty cool.
Awesome. So you've mentioned a few different birds of prey. And on that topic, is there a good way for people to protect their gardens or small animals from hungry birds without harming the birds?
I do a lot of gardening, and I like to attract the birds, but when they eat all my blueberries, I'm not very happy. So I actually built a cover over my berry patch, and I've tried different things, and I ended up with just a really lightweight bird netting that's plastic. Because they make some bird netting that's more cloth-like, but it'll actually catch the birds. They'll get all wrapped up in it and die or get predated by something. So the really lightweight plastic that has, I don't know, it's probably around half-inch mesh, something like that. The birds can fly into it and grab a hold of it, and they don't get caught in it or anything. And it's pretty easy to put over a small frame, that sort of thing.
So on the topic of helping and protecting wild birds, what can people do for wild birds, either to help them thrive or just reduce human disturbance?
If you're somebody that has some property, either just a lot in town or property away from town, some of the main things to think about are just the diversity of habitats and possibly having some water. Because like we mentioned, different habitats provide places for different birds. And sometimes if you have a really particular habitat, like if your backyard is Mildred Knight Park or something like that, you can kind of emphasize and make that particular native habitat really healthy for species that live there, because that habitat is kind of slowly decreasing. Any grassland in oak savanna habitat slowly decreasing, you know, it's getting taken over by vineyards, blueberries, other kind of permaculture agriculture. So sometimes if you have a particular scarce habitat, instead of making that super diverse, you might just emphasize that particular habitat because it's relatively scarce. But sometimes people have opportunity to maybe cut back on some of the invasive species of plants and just help areas thrive. If you've got some water that you can make available, things like, one of the things I've done at my place is I took a couple logs and put them in the ground vertical so that I have a couple snags, and the woodpeckers have just gone crazy with those. And then, of course, once the woodpeckers make holes, then the other cavity nesters nest in there as well. Those are a couple of things.
Yeah, definitely. Like planting native plants or putting out water for the birds, plants with flowers that hummingbirds like that.
What do each of you do to prevent collisions with glass?
I don't really do anything to prevent it. It's never really happened at my house, so.
Yeah, we don't get very many collisions. We get an occasional one. I mean, our house is basically, what do they call it? Just a small ranch-style house, not any big windows. We do occasionally get a bird that hits a window, but it's pretty unusual. And it's usually more of a problem with people that have larger windows or more windows so the birds can see all the way through and they think they're going to be able to get all the way through. And people try different things, different stickers and stuff. If you really do have a problem, one of the best things I've seen is just to use some of that really lightweight plastic bird netting that I was talking about for protecting your berries. And you can actually just hang it in front of the window. So the birds either see that, or if they don't see it, slows them down so they don't hit the window.
So I've heard a lot about cats. Are outdoor cats as big of a problem as I've heard?
That's what they say. I don't have any personal data, and I don't have cats.
We have two cats. We used to have three. I mean, certain cats will go for birds more. Just what I've seen with our three cats. One of them is always outside running around our yard chasing birds. I think he only caught like one. I got him to release it though and it flew off. But yeah, to some extent.
I think that a part of the problem is that maybe people don't always watch their outdoor cats. So even though it seems like they might not be catching anything, they could be behind the scenes. I know that I've had outdoor cats before as a child, and they really attacked the ducklings, like, a lot. And so I think that even necessarily if you don't find them, it doesn't mean it's not happening, because I didn't know about the duckling epidemic until I was little and I crawled underneath the house. Our house was, like, lifted, and there was this hole that I crawled into, which was unsafe, of course. Don't do that. But, there were just so many dead birds down there, and I'm fairly certain that it was a result of our cats, especially the barn cats from our neighbors that really wreaked havoc on the bird population.
So, moving on, would you say that bird feeders and nesting boxes are a good idea for people to keep on their properties?
Nesting boxes, yes. Bird feeders, yeah.
Is there a specific type of bird seed that accommodates more species?
I just use a mix of like sunflower seeds and millet seed. I also have suet feeders up, so woodpeckers come, and then the smaller birds like chickadees, sparrows, towhees, finches, they eat the millet and the sunflower seeds.
All right. And Abraham, have you had any significant mentors or guides that helped you develop your skills in birding? Or have you mostly built your skills through personal experience and research?
Well, Matt's helped a lot. He's helped me identify a lot of birds.
And I guess that goes for you too, Matt. Have you had any significant mentors?
Definitely. When I first got interested, I had at least a handful of people that I spent a lot of time with that I learned a lot from, went birding with a lot. And of course, when I started, there was no internet. So yeah, we actually had to, you know, get together to learn from each other. And we might talk on the phone, but that doesn't really, you know, you can't share photos and stuff.
Yeah.
On a phone that you have to dial. And, but, you know, after a lot of that initial learning, and I can see this with Abraham too, it really is just the time you spend out there doing something, getting those experiences. It's those experiences and kind of puzzling things out and learning just by being out there that really develops your skills ultimately.
So that actually raises a good question for me. So pre-internet or pre-easily accessible internet, how did you go about learning the bird calls?
Well, that was really fun. I could still remember, I guess I was in late high school. I would go out on the deck from my house out in Umpqua. And, you know, at first, I think I knew two or three birds. I knew what a robin sounded like. Maybe what a red-tailed hawk sounded like. But anyway, I would go out on the deck and I would listen. And if there was something I didn't know what it was, I would grab my binoculars and go find it. And I think the listening to it, thinking about it, and then, you know, the effort to go find it and see it and then finally find it, kind of like finding a treasure or something, it really helps set that connection between the visual and the audio of the bird, set it in my mind. And then I would just keep listening to it and I would just kind of repeat that process. Anytime I would hear something I didn't know what it was, I would go find it. Sometimes I would record them. There's some birds that sound really similar, say like chipping sparrows and dark-eyed juncos when they're singing. And at first, I just wasn't sure. They both have some variations that kind of overlap a little bit. So I would actually record those. That was back when it was just cassette tapes. And play it back, and I would listen to it over and over and over. Then I'd listen to the other one over and over and over until I thought I had detected a difference that, you know, that I could hear. And then I would go test that in the field and, you know, hear one and say, well, I think that's a such and such. I think that's a junco or that one's a chipping sparrow, and go find it and just verify it. So it took some work, but it's pretty satisfying.
Yeah, I do that a lot even now. Just go out and just listen to all the sounds, and you hear when you don't know what it is, you go find it and use your binoculars, try and identify it by sight and listen to the sound.
And now for some brief announcements. Do you know any youth ages 17 or under who would be interested in a summer adventure? Tell them about Umpqua Watershed's Twin Lakes Youth Wilderness Campout from July 22nd to July 24th. This campout is a summer weekend filled with scientific activities and fun outdoor adventures. Ages 12 through 17 are welcome unattended, but at least one chaperone is preferred for children ages 11 and under. Some extra tents and sleeping bags are available to borrow. To sign up or for more details, email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. Kids for Nature is a free summer program for Douglas County youth ages 7 through 12. It began as an idea presented by a local 9-year-old during Umpqua Watershed's Eco Innovations Challenge last year and has blossomed into a multi-week program. Youth participants will explore local parks, go on hikes, learn about local environment, and create various nature art projects using materials collected. This year, the program will take place on Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. and will run from August 1st to August 16th. You can sign up your child for a week at a time or for all sessions. To sign up for Kids for Nature, email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. That's viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. If you love to read and would like to discuss environmental topics with fellow bookworms, try Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club. Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club meets over Zoom every other month and will next meet on Saturday, July 30th. The book to be discussed will be Rivers of Oregon by Tim Palmer, or Scenic Rivers, an American Legacy, also by Tim Palmer. All sessions take place virtually at 5 p.m. on their date. For more information, please email Umpqua Watershed's Director of Education and Outreach, Ryan Kincaid, at her email, ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. That's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Or, if you'd like to share your environmental knowledge with the community by being interviewed for an episode of Living Downstream, email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org.
That's VIVIANA at umquawatersheds.org.
Did you run into any confusion with the same type of bird making multiple noises in different contexts?
Oh, yeah. A lot of birds do make, you know, a handful of different, sometimes a lot of different sounds. Some of them have particular songs, and then some of them have a few calls. I think they call them calls versus a song just because they're just short little notes, you know, little chips or tweets or whatever. People have studied different birds, like, say, hermit warblers or black-throated gray warblers, and even some of the males that are different ages, you know, more kind of dominant birds sing a different song than the younger birds. And sometimes ones that arrive early have one song, ones that arrive later have a different song. And if you go to different parts of their range, their songs will vary. So there's a lot of variation. So sometimes when you're learning bird sounds, you know, the cadence and the rhythm and that sort of thing helps a lot, but ultimately it's what really helps a lot is just the tone of their voice. And, you know, we do that just with people because somebody can call you on the phone and say, "Hi, Matt, how you doing?" And two different people can say the exact same thing, but their quality of their voice is different. A good example of that is like with northern flickers and pileated woodpeckers. They both make kind of a da-da-da-da-da-da sound, but the pileated has more of a, what I think of as a voice-like call, and the flicker's a little more shrill. So just that quality of the sound is different, even if they both are making sort of a repeated note.
What would you both say is the most challenging aspect of birding or bird photography?
I think maybe identifying birds, or like identifying them by their calls.
Yeah, I feel like the challenges for birding or photography, I mean, obviously they're related, but I think of them as really different. Just birding, initially, one of the biggest challenges is just to get what you feel like is a good look at a bird, especially any of the little warblers and things that are up in the trees and zipping around in the leaves and everything. At first, that's just really difficult, can be really frustrating, which is why starting with like ducks or hawks and big things that sit there makes it a lot easier. And with photography, one of the biggest things people have trouble with is two things. One is that the birds are moving, and if they just have their camera set on auto, for example, almost all the photos, you know, if the bird's moving, if it's just sitting on a post, then no problem. But if the bird's moving, the shutter speed will almost always be too slow, and so you'll get a blurry picture. So one of the first things you need to start off with is learning your camera so that you can be sure it's, you know, if you're taking pictures of moving birds, a thousandth of a second or quicker. And the other thing is that when the birds are, again, not just sitting on a post, but in some vegetation, is it's really hard to get your camera to focus on the bird. And a lot of people, especially beginners, will have their camera set on some kind of autofocus. And so one of the big things that helps there is to set the type of focus to a point versus the whole view, because if you're just focusing on the whole view, you're always going to be focusing on the branches. But if you have a point focus, you can, you know, it takes a lot of practice. And thankfully, with digital cameras, you can take a lot of pictures that didn't work that you can delete later. But at least you can work at getting that point right on the bird so it'll focus on the bird. And if your camera has an option to focus manually, that can help too, because then you don't have to rely on that autofocus.
Yeah, certain birds, like If you're shooting through like a tree and you're just trying to get a good shot of it so you can try and identify it, you can't do autofocus because it's just going to focus on one of the branches. So manual focus is pretty helpful for that, just as long as it stays still long enough.
For people with lower quality cameras, do you have any tips for perhaps getting close enough to birds that might be skittish?
Being quiet, not really looking at the bird, kind of slowly walking towards it. Like if you're walking on a path and there's trees and stuff, just walking slowly, not really looking at it, trying to make it seem like you're just walking past, but kind of walking an angle slanted towards them a little bit so you can get closer.
You can also go someplace and let the birds come to you. Things like a bird bath or a spring up in the mountains, or sometimes you can watch a bird and see that it repeatedly comes back to a particular branch or something. So you can go put yourself there near a particular branch or a little pool of water or a bush with berries in it or whatever that seems to be attracting the birds, and just sit and wait there, because like Abraham's indicating, a lot of times if you just try and walk up to them, they're going to fly away. So if you get someplace where they come to you, that helps a lot.
There's also certain birds in like the spring, they have, when they're mating season, they have these little bushes in a field or whatever. They have their little perches and they'll make their rounds going to each one. And a lot of times you can watch that and just see where they're always at. I've noticed that with like the common yellow throats. They'll perch on top of a little bush all the time and sing.
Good advice.
And Abraham, do you have any intentions to incorporate birds or photography into a future career or a group?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure yet.
So how do you two both feel about climate change? How is it affecting our native birds?
I guess it depends, you know, at the larger like continental level. I'll let people just go read on the internet. You can find articles and studies that give, you know, some people's views on that. Locally, you know, at a small level, all we can really think about is kind of the changes that we see, which are really different. You know, the last 10, 15 years, we've had a lot of drought. And so that's kind of just changed a lot of things. You know, it changes how much vegetation we have in the spring. It changes how much water we have in the rivers. The Umpqua Valley has experienced a lot of dead Douglas firs, which, you know, anytime the habitat changes, it's not so good for some species and it's good for other species. So like the dying firs, there's some birds, maybe like evening grosbeaks and pine siskins, that might like those firs, but when they all die, or when a lot of them die, you end up getting a lot more snags and habitat for woodpeckers. So there are pluses and minuses to that. And then this spring, you know, we had a really wet spring, which also has pluses and minuses. It seemed to me, you know, things were really warm in, I think it was March. A lot of my fruit trees were blooming. There were bees everywhere. And then in April, it got cool. And when it gets cool in the spring, it's birds like, well, aerial insectivores. So ones like swallows and flycatchers that almost exclusively eat flying insects. They have a hard time when the weather gets really cold and rainy, because there aren't near as many insects flying. Whereas when it's warmer and less rainy, there are a lot of aerial insects for them to eat.
What are some common birds in Roseburg and surrounding areas?
Oh, Abraham.
I mean, a lot of chickadees, sparrows, finches, house finch, woodpeckers everywhere. I mean, the most abundant species of woodpecker I've seen is the acorn woodpecker. Any forest with oak, they're everywhere. They nest in there. Ducks find a pond, like the pond sewer park. Lots and lots of ducks and geese. Herons. Those are really cool. ospreys nest along the river. You have any species to add to that?
No, those are some good ones. One thing I want to just throw in here somewhere is there's a website that I worked on a few years ago called umpquabirds.org, and it has, we could just say, answers to a lot of common questions that people have, like what are some common birds in the area? How do I learn about the birds? What else can I do? Are there any surveys I can do? That sort of thing. So that's a place to go to begin exploring birds in our area.
Do either of you have any other tips or resources for beginners that are trying to identify birds?
There's a website called allaboutbirds.org. You can basically search any species of bird and it'll show you photos and tell you what they eat and all those sorts of facts about them. There's also a sound identification app that I've used a few times. It's called a Merlin Bird ID. That helps for a lot of beginners just to record the sounds and get an idea of what they're listening to.
If you like submitting information and kind of contributing to citizen science, that sort of thing, there's a couple good places to do that. One is ebird.org and the other one is iNaturalist. Both of them, you know, you can submit your own sightings there. You can submit photos, just your records of things that you see. But you can also learn a lot by going to either one of those sites. And you can, for example, you can query, say, just for Douglas County, see, well, what kind of birds have people seen in my area? What kind of birds have people seen in the last week in my area? And you can look up some of that kind of thing there. So that's pretty helpful, I think.
Yeah, I've used that a little bit, seeing what other species people have seen and where they've seen them. Because like you said, I mean, all sorts of birds and all of these different habitats. And you can search species and see what locations they've been seen at. And sometimes if it's like a public location, you can go there and look for that species, try and see it.
Is there anywhere people can go to view your photography?
I post a lot of my stuff on Facebook. My dad runs a Facebook group called Rose Brig Tracker, and I post all my wildlife photos there.
And what about you, Matt?
I have lots of photos in eBird and iNaturalist. In both of those places, you can actually search by person. But you don't have to just look up my stuff. If you go and say, just look at Douglas County, for example, there will be dozens or maybe hundreds of people that have submitted their photos there.
There's thousands and thousands of photos. I mean, I went through your photos to see what species you've seen, where you've seen them. You have a lot. You got like 4,400, I think, something like that.
Yeah, in eBird, yeah.
Well, do either of you two have any questions for each other or for me?
Well, Viviana, what do you see in your future of being interested in birds? Are you wanting to learn some more? Are you just kind of floating along and see what happens? Or?
A little bit of both. I know that there are a lot of seasonal job opportunities for wildlife monitoring, and some of those involve birds. So some experience or knowledge about birding would be helpful in that kind of situation, especially for like spotted owls, for example. Janice Reed, the president of Umpqua Watersheds, used to do a lot of spotted owl surveys, and that requires a whole lot of hiking and sitting around and waiting for the birds and trying to gather data. So if I ever go into seasonal work that requires surveying the bird population, it is important to know some basic bird facts and how to go about gathering data for them.
Yeah.
So I guess just out of curiosity, personal curiosity, there are these tiny glossy black birds that can be found in basically every parking lot ever. I used to call them parking lot birds. What is their natural habitat? Where are they supposed to be? And what is the appeal of parking lots?
What do they look like?
They're small, they're black, and they're glossy. I think that they come in slightly dimmer shades. I don't know if those are like the females.
Are there some brownish colored ones? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those are the dimmer ones.
Brewers Blackbirds.
Oh, okay.
Pretty sure. I've seen a lot of them in parking lots.
They didn't evolve until parking lots came along. Just kidding. Yeah. Just kidding.
I think one reason is probably parking lots in front of stores and Costco, any other store I got, or like in front of restaurants, people dropping food or insects on the ground. I think that would be one reason why. Do you have any ideas?
Well, so away from parking lots, really aren't very many away from parking lots, but they usually nest in some kind of fairly dense shrub. And around parking lots and, you know, shopping malls and residential areas, there's almost always some kind of dense shrub. And, you know, sometimes some stores or restaurants have trouble with nesting pairs that are dive bombing on people that are trying to get into the store because they have a nest right in the hedge.
Right next to the door.
Yeah, right where people walk from the, you know, from their car to the store. But you can find them up places on the coast or up at around Diamond Lake. But it's interesting. They're hardly ever out, say, you know, in a clear cut or a natural shrubby field or something like that. And there are a few species that, and a couple other examples are cliff swallows, barn swallows, of course, house sparrows that are introduced. There are a few species that mostly nest in human created habitats. And it does make you wonder, like, well, where would they be if we weren't here? And some of them might still be around or not. I'm not sure. In Western Oregon, I'm not sure I've ever seen a barn swallow nest on something other than a human-built structure. In Eastern Oregon, barn swallows sometimes nest inside the openings of caves. But cliff swallows are similar. They mostly nest under bridges. But there are a few places along, like the North Umpqua Highway or the Umpqua Highway going to the coast. There are a few places where they actually nest on cliffs, but the vast majority of them nest under bridges.
Yeah, for the cliff swallows, there's the bridge closest to the dam that goes over the river. There's a lot of cliff swallows. They nest under that bridge. And then the only thing I can think of that might have been a barn swallow is we have a friend that lives out in Melrose. They have a tree next to their house, and I don't know if it was a barn swallow or not, but like the trunk of the tree goes up and it splits off in like three different main parts of the tree, and right in the middle of that there was a bird's nest completely made of mud and like a few pieces of grass. I don't know if that was a barn swallow's or not, but might have been.
Another exceedingly common bird that I see all over the place are just these pigeons, the gray ones with the kind of colorful, shiny necks. I've heard rumors that those are actually not a natural species and that they were a domesticated species, kind of like dogs came from wolves. Pigeons came from more wild ancestors. Is that true? And if so, should we be doing something about that, do you think?
Those band-tailed pigeons, you think?
I think she's talking about the rock pigeons.
Rock pigeon.
It's called rock doves. And there are native rock pigeons over, I don't remember, I think it's like the Middle East or somewhere on a different continent. But a lot of people in the United States keep them as pets or homing pigeons or just to breed, you know, different appearances of these birds. But they've, just like some plants, I would call them kind of naturalized. In other words, they have escaped, so to speak, but then they've found places to nest, and it's usually under bridges. There are a few places I know, like in Eastern Oregon, some bluffs and stuff where they actually nest on an actual cliff or holes in the cliff and that sort of thing. But in Western Oregon, for the most part, they just nest around bridges and buildings. And I don't know, you know, they mostly just eat things that humans have created. You know, they find grain and, you know, like over at the wildlife ponds in Roseburg, people feed the pigeons as well. And probably if there weren't any humans around, at least in Western Oregon, I'm not sure there would be any rock pigeons anymore.
So would you say that they're mostly harmless to the environment?
Yeah, I don't see any big competition. For example, like once you get away from the city, unless you have some grain, you know, if you're a farmer that has grain silos, wheat or corn or something, then they'll probably be there eating scraps or, you know, stuff that is dropped by the trucks or whatever. But out here where I live in Melrose, I think I've only seen a rock pigeon once. Out here, I have lots of mourning doves and Eurasian collared doves, which were also introduced and expanded all over the U.S.
Yeah, I've never really seen rock pigeons near my house. Definitely mourning doves. Recently, I saw a flock of band-tailed pigeons, several actually, out near my house flying around. Mourning doves and Eurasian collared doves.
So band-tailed are big pigeon that are native, and they mostly, not completely, but they mostly leave Oregon in the winter and come back in the summer.
Is there a very easy way to tell apart the native versus invasive?
The Eurasian collared dove has, I mean, its name, Eurasian collared, it has a black collar around its neck. Mourning doves don't have that. The band-tailed pigeons are kind of, they're not the same color. They're like a darker kind of, I don't know, like a purplish color kind of, wouldn't you say, Matt?
Yeah, it's kind of grayish and purplish here and there. And they have the band-tailed pigeons have a white collar on the back.
Yeah.
And speaking of identification, for our area, I would recommend something like a Sibley Western Guide. So Sibley is just the name of the David Allen Sibley, the author. But there are so many bird books out there these days. And there's apps that you can put on your phone that can help you narrow down what you're seeing, like that Merlin app that Abraham was talking about. You can type in, you know, you select something like, oh, was it the size of a little sparrow or the size of a goose or whatever, and then what colors did it have, and was it in a tree or on the water or whatever, and then it'll give you some possibilities, like, well, based on what you said, it could be one of these based on where you're located. So that's kind of fun. There's apps that are basically just the physical paper field guide transferred to a phone app. I have the Sibley Bird Guide on my phone, so I don't even carry around my physical bird book anymore.
Yeah, with the All About Birds website, if you can get like a recording of a bird or get a photo, you can, if you get a recording, audio recording, you can listen to it. And then if you think it might be a certain species, you can type in the species on the website and pull up photos and audio recordings and compare the two and see if it might be that bird.
Well, do either of you have any questions or comments to wrap us up with?
I'm wondering, Abraham, do you have any particular bird aspirations? Are you just kind of enjoying what you're finding around here, or do you have any other plans?
Yeah, I just enjoy watching birds. Just around my house, around Douglas County, taking photos, sharing them with people. I really enjoy it.
Me too.
Well, thank you both so much for appearing on Living Downstream. Abraham, Matt, it was great having you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Viviana.